listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon, you're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor. And today, I have an interview I recorded this past week that I'm excited to share with you. And I'll start off by saying I chose this specific guest and the specific topic for a special reason. As you may have heard, Vice President Mike Pence is coming to Spokane tomorrow, October 2nd, for a fundraiser for Kathy Morris Rogers. And I have a lot of feelings about Vice President Mike Pence. And so do many other people. So you can look online for this information. But there are multiple groups planning to protest this appearance. The paper today shared that the Trump baby balloon will be present. There's a brigade of handmaids using imagery from The Handmaid's Tale book and show, who will be assembled at 4 p.m. tomorrow. The location is still unknown, but there's a lot of places. Spokane Now, National Organization for Women, and the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane have that information posted on their social media and websites. So why this reaction to Vice President Mike Pence? If folks aren't familiar with him, for me, the topic I chose today and the guest I chose today, I chose based on one notable quote of Mike Pence's, which he has said, he's repeated it on many occasions. It's a sort of personal slogan. And that's that he says, quote, "I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order." There are many other descriptors that don't appear on the list at all. But he is one of the most openly kind of theocratic leaders that we've seen in this country. So he also notoriously does not professionally, in a professional context or any context, dine alone with women who aren't his wife. So I guess that cancels out, you know, a female lawyer in the White House, a female chief of staff, etc. So there's a lot of issues with Mr. Pence that I'm not going to dive too deeply into, but talking about his religiosity, his openness about his religiosity being a factor in the way that he governs, really inspired me to reach out to Paul Kivel, who's my guest today in this pre-recorded interview. Paul has been spending the most recent part of his career writing about the idea of Christian hegemony. So, you know, hegemony being kind of the total dominance over all of the streams of life. And he talks about Christianity in that way in our culture, which is something that I don't think gets broached a lot. When I was first introduced to his work and these ideas, it really made me shift a lot of the ways I was thinking. So I'm excited to share this interview. A little bit about Paul. He's a social justice educator, activist, and writer. He has been an innovative leader in violence prevention for 35 years. He's a trainer and speaker on men's issues, racism and diversity, challenges of youth, teen dating and family violence, the impact of class and power on daily life. He is the author of numerous books and curricula, including Living in the Shadow of the Cross, which is the book that we're kind of talking about in this interview. He also wrote Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. He wrote Men's Work, Making the Peace, and many more titles. So you can find his work at paulkivel, KIVEL.com. So without further ado, I'm going to launch us into this interview, and I hope you enjoy it. And yeah, it's dedicated to Vice President Mike Pence.
I'm Paul Kivel. I'm a social justice educator, activist, and writer, and I've been working around the issues of violence prevention and social justice and in terms of economic inequality, race, gender, class, sexual orientation, sexual identity and ability, etc., for many decades at this point, and I'm always glad to be in the conversation to explore the issues of power and privilege and violence and exploitation and how to build community and create the society that we really want to live in.
Great. And so that work obviously has been going on for years for you. You've published some books on anti-racism that I know of, and then most recently, to my knowledge, on this topic that we're going to cover today, Christian hegemony. So can you get into a little bit of what your definition of Christian hegemony or Christian dominance is and kind of how that other work led you to work on that?
Okay. Well, after many years of working on issues of racism and sexism and economic inequality, I began to see that underneath these different systems of oppression were a combination of powerful institutions and individuals and a worldview, a set of dominant concepts, which over the centuries have coalesced into something that shapes the way we think, the way we behave, our public policy and foreign policy, and that the foundation of a lot of that was really dominant Christianity. And so I put Christian hegemony in the middle of a piece of butcher paper and other systems of oppression around it, and started drawing lines and making connections and seeing how, without understanding the kind of one the central role that Christian dominance plays in our society, that we're really inadequately understanding racism and sexism, and also that our strategies for changing the world are seriously sabotaged and undermined without an adequate understanding of the way the roots of Christian dominance hold together.
Cool. So
I define Christian hegemony as the everyday, pervasive, and systematic set of Christian values and beliefs, individuals and institutions that dominate all aspects of our society through the social, political, economic, and cultural power that they wield. And it's a system of oppression. It's complex, it's flexible, and it operates on multiple levels. So let me just lay out some of those levels that the system operates on. One level is the internalization of key Christian concepts, what we might call a dominant Christian worldview, by individuals in our society. Another level is the power that individual preachers, ministers, and priests have on people's lives and in our communities. A third level is the significant political and economic power that particular churches and Christian denominations wield. We see this in the area of public policy around reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, things like that in particular. Yeah. Another level that Christian dominance operates on is the vast network of parachurch organizations. These are broadly Christian but not tied to a single denomination, which are general tax-supported nonprofits such as hospitals, broadcasting networks, publishing houses, lobbying groups, organizations like Focus on the Family, Prison Fellowship, World Mission, The Family, on and on. There's literally tens of thousands of these parachurch organizations. The other two levels that I want to mention, one is the power elite, the network of maybe 10 to 15,000 of the most powerful primarily white Christian men in our society who run the major institutions, the social, political, economic, and cultural institutions of our country, and the influence that they wield, the control they have over our daily lives. And the final level, and this is really the cultural level, is the long and deep legacy of Christian ideas, values, practices, policies, icons, and texts that have been reproduced over the centuries and continue to shape our everyday behavior and also to frame our public and foreign policy decisions. Wow. So that's where we should start.
Okay. So right up front, you know, you're not talking about the existence of Christianity as, you know, a power system inherently. You're talking about all of the institutional and other forms of power that it monopolizes in our culture. Is that a correct distillation?
Well, some of those are explicitly Christian and some of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm understanding you correctly, then we have to look at both the ones that are explicitly Christian and then those that are not, but are reproducing the dominant concepts, the political institutions, you know, and informing the way things are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
so
it's, I'm not talking about individual Christians because individual Christians are diverse and have lots and lots of different ways to relating to dominant Christianity. And I'm not talking about Christianity per se, because there's a lot of different alternative Christianities that have been in juxtaposition to and even in opposition to dominant Christianity. So we can talk about liberation theologies and black churches and feminist theologies and various contemporary and historical alternative forms of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So complex, but you did a really good job summarizing all of it in a short time. And I want to go back to that Butcher paper, which is really the foundation of so much social justice work, is a big Butcher paper legal pad. And, you know, you put Christian hegemony in the center and started drawing out those arrows. And for me, I think the most obvious one, and it's because of my situation as a woman in our society, but is sexism. I think that's the one that springs up primarily. But I'd like to kind of explore a specific one just to get into this idea. What did your racism line look like when you pulled it off of that Christian hegemony center?
Well, let's start with the gender one first, because, of course, there's patriarchies in lots of different societies and lots of different religions. But what's unique in our society is the way that Christianity has shaped patriarchy into particular forms. So starting with the creation story and the concept of original sin and the blaming of women for as a source of evil in the world, all the way through the 250 years or so of witch burnings and public trials and torture of women, that there's various ways that Christianity has shaped and formed sexism or patriarchy or male supremacy, whatever words we use, in our society today. And similarly with race, racism really came out of the attempts in Spain in the 15th century to create a pure Christian society that excluded Muslims and Jews and became a legal system that eventually determined that if anyone with even one drop of non-Christian blood could not be a citizen of the Spanish society and it was vulnerable to either being expelled or killed. And, you know, this was the origins of contemporary racism as it's been shaped in Western societies.
And then that's operated in a through line to the present day?
Right. I mean, well, clearly we had a, during much of our society here in the U.S., we've had a one-drop rule in terms of legal segregation and exploitation. But just the sense that white Christians constitute a pure, normal, centralized version of humanity, and everybody who is labeled non-white, non-Christian, is outside the community boundaries, you know, is dangerous, is polluting, is evil in some way.
Mm-hmm. And so to what extent do you think, in the U.S. specifically, is this idea of Christian dominance built into the foundations And to what extent has it, how has it evolved in a structural sense in terms of our institutions?
It's definitely built into the foundations. It's built in a number of ways. One is that the colonizing countries in Europe, Portugal, Spain, France, Britain, Holland, etc., were following the mandates of the church, the Roman Catholic Church, that claimed divine control over the world and said that the Christians had the permission and obligation to go out and convert everyone in the world, wherever they were, to Christianity. And in doing that, they could enslave them, they could take their property, they could colonize, take over their land, they virtually unlimited freedom to go to any place that wasn't already claimed by Christians. And this was called the Doctrine of Discovery. It was issued in papal bulls in the 15th century, and all of the European countries followed that mandate. They used that as to guide them in their actions in other countries in Africa, North and South America, etc. And so that is part of the legal foundation of the U.S. and is still cited in court cases as precedents in terms of indigenous and U.S. government relationships. Similarly, the exploitation and domination of people of color, particularly African Americans, has always been based on this, was a longstanding concept that non-Christians were heathens, infidels, that they were dangerous, that they were a source of evil, and not fully human. And so it's still very much built into our laws and our public policy around the way that people of color are marginalized, excluded, and still dehumanized in our cultural media.
Yeah, and so, and all of this has continued, despite the fact that, and correct me if I'm wrong, you probably have data on this, and I'm just pulling it out of the back corner of my brain, but I know over the past century, and specifically the last 4 or 5 decades, American society as a whole has become more secular on an individual level. Is that correct? That the individuals
correct.
Identify less as religious in general. And yet this,
right.
this influence
this point,
is still pervasive.
30% of the population identifies as non-Christian, as other in some category.
And is that having an impact on this overall pattern of dominance?
Not particularly. I mean, if we look at the Supreme Court, if we look at our political parties, if we look at who's leading our corporations, our cultural institutions, think tanks, universities, we still have primarily white Christian males in power and with the accumulation of the most wealth. And if we look in our cultural media, the icons and stories and images of dominant Christianity are still primarily what we see and would guide people's beliefs and behavior. So it's not about numbers per se, although the numbers are significant. It's about power and wealth and control.
Mm-hmm. And while that's, you know, while we're talking about the U.S., to back up to where you were talking before about the doctrine of discovery, maybe we can also address, I know I'm going all over the place here, but how these ideas have affected U.S. foreign policy and kind of U.S. Imperial moves as well. This kind of idea that popularized in the Bush administration, but I think it predates that and continues beyond it, of the U.S. as being engaged in kind of a holy war or a you know, a right. conquest that's been sanctioned by God.
Actually, I mean, it's pervasive within European countries as well as the U.S. and in South Africa and New Zealand, Australia, various settler Christian countries. This concept that anywhere in the world is kind of our domain, and if it's not Christian yet, it should be, that we are blessed by God. We call that manifest destiny or American exceptionalism, that we can go anywhere to save people, to help people, that we are the good guys, and everybody else is inferior in, and needs our help. And so a lot of our interference, our exploitation and military invasions of other country is based on this concept that in truth and democracy and free markets and Christianity and all of God's goodies to those who don't yet have them. Of course, in the Cold War, this was really explicit because communism was seen as a form of atheism, and the evil enemy of the United States, which was the God's chosen country. But that goes all the way back to the Pilgrims and the idea of the city on the hill, and the people here being the white people here being the role models for the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I mean, the Cold War is when we get under God inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance, right?
Right, and in God we trust on our currency, and just the it was talked about very explicitly. But like you mentioned, Bush really actually used the word crusade after 9/11 to talk about the, you know, that it, and the crusades were, you know, started 1,000 years ago. But for that entire 1,000 years, pretty much always Muslims were the enemy outside, the threat against Christianity and Christendom.
Mm-hmm. And I believe Bush also, this was less in public addresses and more in information that came out from inside the administration, but he was known to, you know, quote revelations and talk about end times prophecy in reference to our excursions and imperial wars in the Middle East. So how does that kind of the end times theology play into Christian hegemony in general? You know, we've talked about the savior complex and some of those other things, but how does that specific flavor of Christianity, I suppose, influence the rest of these systems?
I think the apocalyptic kind of aspect of dominant Christianity has always been very strong. Even today, about half of the U.S. population thinks that the end times will come within their lifetime. That's a tremendous amount of people in this country who believe concretely that in that apocalyptic vision. It comes out of the sense that of revelations, in particular in the New Testament, but also from the cosmic battle between good and evil, between God and the devil, and the dualism of dominant Christianity, and the sense that there is a cosmic battle going on, and people have to be on one side or another. It's very simple-minded, and it's and you know, Bush said, "You're either with us or against us," and that's something that presidents have said for the last couple hundred years, and it's a common framework in our society. Which side are you on? Are you with us or against us? And if you're against us, it doesn't mean that you have a different opinion or that you have different interests. It means you're actually representing the interests of evil and the devil in the world, and therefore, it's not about negotiations or compromise. It's about annihilation and destruction, because you don't compromise. You don't even talk to evil. You just have to kill it and eliminate it. So it definitely influences our propensity to go to war, to attack other countries, and people's kind of sense of end times. It also, I think, has it undermines our environmental justice work that so many people in this country don't actually care about what happens to the environment because the world's going to end anyway, and therefore we shouldn't be paying that much attention to what's going on with the environment. And coupled with a dominant Christian concept that humans were given dominion over the earth by God, then the two concepts together mean that there's kind of very little effort or attention on controlling the devastation that's happening to the natural world.
Yeah. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Paul Kivel. He is author of, among other books, Living in the Shadow of the Cross, which is on this idea of Christian hegemony that we're discussing. I'll mention also that we're discussing it in, I chose to interview Paul this week because tomorrow, Tuesday, October 2nd, Spokane will be visited by Vice President Mike Pence, who perhaps we can get into to him specifically a little bit and what he represents, his wing of the current administration, how it fits into these ideas. So, yeah, but that idea about the environment is one of the key things that jumps out at me because that's my main background is in environmental activism, and hearing that, you know, that you know, we can't mess it up too much because we're supposed to be in control. Humans are supposed to be on top of this imaginary pyramid with everything else on Earth below us.
Right, and one of the things that leads to is people being unable to comprehend what it is like to live interdependently with the natural world in mutual and balanced relationships. And so even the environmental work that some Christians do is changing dominion to stewardship, but still with humans in control and on top, and not with a real a sense of interdependence and balance and mutuality, I would say. We really need to understand kind of the core of how that hinders our ability to have really radical solutions to the environmental crisis we face.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, tied up into all of that and into what you were talking about before is kind of the idea of predestination, either with specific individuals or also just destiny in terms of God's plan. How does that work? What does that thread look like wherever you'd like to follow it?
Predestination is usually applied to individuals, the sense that our lives are predestined, and in that sense, dominant Christianity says we have a choice to make, to follow God or to follow our evil impulses and move to the side of the devil. But the larger picture is that the belief that there's a linear temporal framework for the world, that God created the world, and kind of the of God. And there was an intercession when Jesus was alive and then killed, and there's an end point, final judgment, an apocalypse, whatever. There, you know, different Christians believe in different scenarios around that, but in the dominant Christian worldview, that this is all laid out by God, and that we're moving along on this linear timeline towards the final times.
Mm-hmm. And that's that's considered, you know, a Western concept. And I think that a lot of the more I hear you talk about this, and the more I read about your writing on this topic, the more I realize the conflation between capital W Western thought and Christianity.
Right. I mean, you know, Western thought developed out of Christian foundations of our society, and the idea of progress was first talked about by Christians in the 12th and 13th centuries, and that's the, you know, all our concepts of progress in the future and development and things that we think about come from this linear time frame that that we really have to question. You know, many societies have linear time frames, but they tend to be more cyclical, based upon the annual cycle or longer term cycles of time. And then for many indigenous people in the world, it's time is less important than place and what happens in that place and what the history and what the natural world of that place is like. So there's lots of other ways to conceive of the world in terms of time and space. And Christianity presents us with a certain kind of time-space framework, and then it dominates and eliminates our ability to think about things more complexly and to be more tied into the natural world.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I guess that unless you protest to this, I would like to move on to just the example of Mike Pence. I think kind of epitomizing the moment that we're at with this concept. He's technically the second most powerful person in the country, and by some estimations, the world, by extension. Can you talk a little bit about him and what wing of Christian dominance he represents?
I can talk a little bit about Mike Pence. I don't know a lot of details about who he is and where he comes from, but he is part of a fundamentalist strain of Christianity, which is called, I think, dominionism. It's about creating the U.S. in the image of a Christian society. It's tied into a view of the seven mountains of a society, the major institutions of society, that is important for Christians to control those seven dominant institutions, the government, the education, you know, things like that. And so it's an explicitly an agenda for not just Christians to be in power, but for the entire society to be reshaped in the image of a perfect Christian society. And in that society, most of us don't have a place because we are considered to be other, whether we're female or queer or trans or Jewish or Muslim or recent immigrants or people of color or indigenous or people with disabilities. All of us are considered not part of that pure Christian society based upon values of purity and goodness and you know, that write us out of the story, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see that, you know, they see themselves waging war or crusades in the name of Christianity against evil. And they don't really care about the casualties of that. And most of us would be casualties if they are able to do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. And he...
Now, there's a lot of variations on that, and Pence is just, you know, part of certain strands of that. But it's highly dangerous because it's associated with tremendous amounts of wealth and influence and power, and is... kind of relentless in these people's attempts to undermine our democratic institutions and the kinds of core values that so many of us hold dear.
Mm-hmm. It's really stark to think about, you know, the ideas, the ideals, whether they've been realized properly or not, of the U.S. around pluralism and around democracy and representation for everyone are so counter to this idea that
it's interesting to think about the fact that people in positions of power who speak to those ideals and give them lip service are also behind, out of the other side of their mouth, you know, talking about being a Christian nation, etc.
Right, and Christians really, and powerful Christians in this sense have the power, have the ability to speak to many millions of Christians in this society who are evangelicals or fundamentalists or Catholics or Protestants of whatever sort, in a language that is coded with biblical references and phrases and terms that have developed, to speak to them in a way which is not readily apparent or clear to the rest of us, because we don't have those frameworks and that vocabulary. And so Bush and Pence and so many others don't sound as radically Christian in that sense as they might, because so much of what they say is coded in dominant Christian language.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. The other thing that's important is that this is, you know, so many people are working to get Trump out of office and impeached and to limit the damage that he can do. But it's not just Mike Pence, but others in the administration and outside of the administration who have these kinds of radical Christian agendas are going to continue. We need to really understand the longer-term struggle to limit their ability to unravel our society and to prevent us from actually creating the inclusive, democratic, and sustainable society that we want to live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just recalled, I mean, Mike Pence is pretty open about it. In some ways, he's quoted as saying that he's a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. So, I mean, he's pretty out front with it. But how do you think, I mean, we can start to get into kind of solution territory here. How do you suggest, based on your work, that we begin to address this kind of deep-seated, quasi-invisible force in our society?
I think one way we begin to address it is to realize it's not just about the far right or conservative Christians or particular parts of dominant Christianity, but we live in a deeply hegemonic Christian society in which we've all been socialized into certain concepts and values, whether we are Christian or not, or whether we've rejected Christianity or not, that a lot of the core concepts of dualism and cosmic battle between good and evil and individualism and domination over nature and on and on, sin and salvation, all that kind of stuff shows up in many ways in our thinking and behavior and in our institutions, and that we have to understand the problem of Christian hegemony as one that's much more deeply rooted than in its most radical manifestations. And without understanding that and understanding the history of and the force which holds that together, and without understanding the actual concrete forms of political power and wealth and control that denominations and churches and individuals have accumulated, we're not able to seriously address what we're up against. I think that, you know, in my book and on my website, the website is christianhegemony.org, where there's lots of resources as well as in the book about what Christians can do, what resistance looks like, how those of us who are not Christian have resisted over the centuries. There's a section on my website of stories of resistance of how different people and organizations are fighting against Christian dominance today, whether it's public policy that supports Christian institutions and infringes on our civil liberties around reproductive rights or LGBTQ rights, or impacts our foreign policy, that there's lots of ways that people are resisting, but we need to understand how the system works, the depths of it, what holds it together, and then basically begin to decolonize our minds as we get together with other people to pick particular issues to struggle around with an understanding of how, whether it's environmental issues or reproductive rights issues or criminal legal system issues or foreign policy issues, that unless we have a lens which helps us understand how Christian dominance has shaped those issues, our solutions and our strategies won't be adequate to the task.
Yeah, and I mean, I've looked through, having read the book, even just doing the exercises that you lay out, kind of the thought exercises of examining your own life and the influence that Christianity and Christian dominance has had in ways you might not initially identify was really helpful, and I'll definitely share the link to the site there. You have facilitated a lot of these conversations through the research process and in sharing this work. What are some of the common barriers, I suppose, that people come up against when they begin to look at this issue? And how do you help them learn through those challenges and barriers?
Well, the common resistance is from Christians, because most people who are not Christian have a pretty clear understanding. They may not have the vocabulary and framework that I'm presenting, but they have a pretty clear understanding of the dominance of Christianity and the negative aspects of that in their lives. So talking about Christians in particular, then there's a lot of Christians who actually have ambivalent relationships with dominant Christianity, because they're queer or trans, or they're women, or they're people with disabilities, or they're people of color, or etc., that even though they're Christian, they're not fully accepted and represented and empowered within Christian institutions. And so there's definitely resistance there, but it's not as much as there is in mainstream Christians in many ways. But one of the things that I come up with a lot is people say, well, that's not my Christianity. I don't believe that. That's not my Jesus. That's fine, but that's a way of saying, well, this isn't my problem. I'm not responsible. It's like white people who say, well, I'm not a racist, or I'm not a member of the Klan. And again, that's fine, but we all as white people have a responsibility to address racial injustice in our society, because we're benefiting at the expense and exploitation of other people. Now, Christians also gain benefits in our society from being Christian or passing as Christian, that and one of that is acceptance and opportunities that people who are not Christian are locked out of. So this, the part of the resistance is realizing or breaking that down, is to realize that whatever your relationship to dominant Christianity, that we all have a responsibility to be working to end it, because it impacts all of us and destroys the structures of our society. The second kind of resistance I get is people immediately say, well, what about Islam? And isn't it worse? And there's such a long history of Islamophobia in our country that people immediately assume that even though Christianity may not be perfect, Islam is far worse and more dangerous, and therefore it's okay because we have to fight the evil enemy out there. And first of all, that's usually based on just stereotypes and misinformation about Islam. And secondly, we're here in the U.S. in a Christian-dominated society, and this is what we're up against. And so you know, it's a distraction from that to start looking at the complexities of Islam and in the many, many different countries and cultures in which it exists, and China and India and Indonesia and Kenya and, you know, the Middle East and all over the world. And we need to not focus our attention on Islam, but actually what we're up against here, which is Christian dominance.
Yeah. And
so those are some kind of common forms of resistance that I think it's important for us to look at.
Mm-hmm. And how have you kind of, I was going to say shepherded, how have you guided people through that?
It depends a lot, you know, on what the situation is, and what the time limit is and what people's motivations are. I mean, I think it's important that we have these conversations one-on-one with people, and in that, in one-on-one conversations, then we can actually have a better sense of who they are and where they're coming from and what their resistance is to looking at this. In workshops and trainings and talks, then it's more of a group process. I've developed some exercises, some of which are on the website or in the book, that, you know, help people move collectively through to an understanding of what I mean and what the system of Christian hegemony looks like. And then if, you know, for people who are working in churches or with religious congregations or explicitly Christian groups, then there's some different exercises to look at how does Christian dominance show up in Christian institutions, even though people might be committed to alternative values than those dominant ones. And then what roles can that institution play in challenging that dominant Christianity? So it depends a lot, you know, who and what and where and how. The how comes out of the others.
Mm-hmm. And just in these last few minutes we have, I'm wondering if you have a favorite a favorite example of resistance, a favorite from your Stories of Resistance section.
I don't know that I have a favorite one. I mean, I think there's a lot of resistance that's really important to uplift. The resistance of indigenous people around the country at Standing Rock and so many other places, and actually throughout the world, protecting sacred sites, protecting their sovereignty, resisting the exploitation of natural resources and the natural environment. It's very inspiring, and it's very frontline work. The atheist community, particularly some of the atheist organizations, have been strong defenders of religious freedom and the separation of church and state, and are constantly bringing lawsuits and challenging the imposition of Christian culture and norms and ceremonies and prayers into our daily lives. And there's lots of battles going on around the country there. For a lot of us, resistance just looks like survival. I mean, for indigenous people, for Jews, for others, we weren't meant to survive ultimately within dominant Christianity. The goal was to move us out of the way and get rid of us. And so resistance can take a lot of different forms, and we need to learn to recognize and understand and see those forms. And then, of course, the resistance of women today, for instance, fighting for ends of sexual assault, domestic violence, reproductive freedom, comp for all wages, full inclusion. These are also forms of resistance to Christian dominance in our society and the dominant Christian agenda, which would continue to marginalize women. And so these we also have to understand as forms of resistance that are even more powerful when we understand their relationship to dominant Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are all good examples. And again, there's a whole section on your website, which is Christian Hegemony HEGEMONY, if you're struggling with that out there, .org. And just in closing, what are some other, if people are more curious about this, aside from your website and your book, Living in the Shadow of the Cross, what are some other resources that you would recommend people access if they're curious?
I would, rather than accessing resources, there's lots of links and resources on the website and in my book. I would say that to start conversations about this topic, to get involved with, if you're Christian, with progressive Christian groups that are social justice based, and bring this framework into that work. If you're outside of Christian institutions, to also get together with others and look at the ways that Christian dominance plays out in the organizations that you're in the institutions, in the community, in the culture. There's lots of resources for personal growth and education, but we also need to be connecting with others and linking up and joining the struggle to challenge the Christian dominance of our society and institutions.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. If you're just catching us at the end here, I've been talking with Paul Kivel. He's the author of Living in the Shadow of the Cross on Christian hegemony in our culture. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you. It's good to be with you and part of the conversation.
If you're just catching us at the end, that was my interview here on Praxis with Paul Kivel. If you missed any part of that and want to check it out, you can find the podcast. I will post this show later tonight. You can find that link on our website, kyrs.org. You can also go directly to subscribe at soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. I also would love to hear from listeners. If you have any feedback, suggestions for future shows, anything like that, you can email me at praxis@kyrs.org. I am just about to get out of here. Again, that show on Christian hegemony, dedicated to Vice President Mike Pence, who will be here in Spokane tomorrow afternoon. There's a few different protests and events planned that you can find online. So I'm sure we're all looking forward to that opportunity to greet him in our fair city. Aside from that, I will be back next week on Indigenous Peoples Day with a great roundtable panel of Indigenous women. So something to look forward to for next week. Until then, you've been listening to Praxis.
Freedom I can't call, no. Choctaw freedom, just a word, yeah. Choctaw freedom look like guns to me.